Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie. And with the omnivore's dilemma, Michael Pollan changed the way we thought about food. In his latest book, could he do the same for how we think about psychedelic drugs? It's entitled How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. The only thing he left out of the title was sex and rock and roll. Maybe we'll get to that, too. Michael Pollan, it's great to see you again. Thanks
so
much for
being
here. Good
to be back. Thanks.
It is great to see you. Congratulations on a fascinating
book. It is fascinating.
But, you know, we think of you, Michael, we think of you as the food guy.
Yeah.
So how did you get from food to psilocybin, LSD, psychedelic drugs?
Well, mushrooms, you know, are in both camps.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
But my interest in psychedelics is part of a longstanding interest I've had, actually, in our relationship to the natural world. I mean, that is my big subject. Food is an important part of that relationship. But another thing we use nature for, whether you're talking about plants or fungi, is to change consciousness. All of us today, I see a cup of coffee right there.
That's right.
Have used a plant to change consciousness. And I've always thought this is a very curious human desire. Why would we have this desire? Why would it be adaptive? And so that I've written about that a few times before in Botany of Desire and articles I've written on drugs. Psychedelics represents the most radical case of taking something from nature that changes your consciousness in dramatic ways. People have been doing it for thousands of years, and I got very interested in discovering why that might be.
But part of the genesis, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael Pollan, was you'd begun to hear that there was some usage in current times, which is very beneficial for people with alcoholism or who believed they were dying and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So there's a practical
thing here, too. The reason I decided to do it now was because I started reading about these studies going on at NYU and Johns Hopkins, very prestigious medical centers, where they were using psilocybin to treat people who had cancer diagnoses, who were alcoholics, and they were really picking up on research that was done in the 50s. Before Timothy Leary and the backlash against psychedelics, and that they were getting very good results. And the idea that you would have a terminal cancer diagnosis and then you would go on a psychedelic seemed to me so weird and so not what I would do that I became curious to know how was this molecule actually helping in that situation.
So before we talk about the promise or potential promise, whatever you want to say, about psychedelics in 2018 and beyond, one of the parts I love about this book is the history. Because Margie and I were
discussing. Which is local.
I was just going to say, so much of it local. Everybody remembers, even if you're young, turn on, tune in, drop out, Timothy Leary, Harvard professor until he was no longer a Harvard professor. Give us, if you can, sort of the Cliff Notes version of the rise and fall of psychedelics in our lives.
Sure. Well, the story goes back. I mean, for most Americans, they didn't tune in to psychedelics until Timothy Leary in the 60s.
You're talking to one.
But it was going on from 1950 or so. There was a very active program of research going on in Canada, in England, and in L.A., and in Vancouver, a couple other places. And they were getting some interesting results, and they were treating it as a new psychiatric intervention. LSD had recently been discovered, and psychiatrists and neuroscientists were trying to figure out, what is it good for? What does it teach us about the brain? How might we help people with it? 1960, a personality researcher named Timothy Leary, very well regarded, has an experience with magic mushrooms in poolside in Cuernavaca. He said he learned more in 4 hours on that trip than he had learned in his entire career as a psychologist, including graduate school. And he had just been hired by Harvard. And he gets back in the fall, and he goes to the chairman of his department and says, "We got to study this. I want to start something called the Harvard Psilocybin Project." And he begins, and they give him approval. Remember, these drugs were all legal at the time. And he starts administering it to people in a naturalistic setting, which was essentially living rooms.
And his graduate students, theoretically, not
that's
undergraduates.
That's right. He was limited. He could give the drug to graduate students, not to undergraduates. Mm. And he would do this in there. And he was living in Newton in his house. And he kind of very quickly became so enchanted by these drugs. And he gradually switched from psilocybin to LSD, which is more powerful, that he lost interest in science. And he went from the idea that we could treat individuals with these drugs to the fact that we needed to treat the entire society. And we don't have a paradigm for treating a whole society, prescribing a drug to a whole society. But he really felt so strongly that it's silly to study this in a double-blind. You can't even really do a good double-blind study, though they tried at Marsh Chapel with a very famous experiment where they gave psilocybin to 20 divinity students in 1961 to see if they could see God. And 10 got the drug, 10 got a placebo. The 10 on the placebo sat in the pews like this, getting really annoyed at the 10 who were like, oh, my God. There he is.
There he is.
And they had this profound religious experience. I don't know what they proved exactly. So he did do some experiments, but over time he just became an evangelist for everybody should use this.
And ultimately, not too long later, as his profile rose, concerns rose, and no less than the President of the United States, yeah. Richard Nixon at the time, didn't the most dangerous man in America.
He called Timothy Leary, by then a washed-up psychology yeah. professor, who had been fired from Harvard, the most dangerous man in America, which is kind of astonishing. But a lot of people, Ronald Reagan believed this too, and Nixon believed that these drugs were really fueling the counterculture and sapping the will of American youth to fight in Vietnam. And in fact, Leary had said this. He said, kids who take LSD will not fight your wars. And so it was, the drugs did have a tremendous effect on the counterculture. They shaped its styles. I think they contributed to this generation gap, which was really unprecedented. You had young people creating their own culture, different way of dressing, different kind of music, different sexual mores, ethics. Everything was different. And this was terrifying to adults and certainly to the people in charge politically. It was the first time in history, I think, where we had a rite of passage that was not knitting culture together, but separating it. Because normally a rite of passage, whether you're talking about a bar mitzvah or a vision quest, is organized by the elders to bring the adolescents right. into adult society. Here, the kids had organized the rite of passage, and it landed them in a country of the mind that no adult knew anything about.
Well, talk about that country of the mind, Michael Pollan, that as you described so well, that people were having these mystical experiences, experiencing a oneness with nature or oneness with God, whatever it was. And unlike usually if you have 17 cocktails and you think you're having a oneness with nature at 2 o'clock in the morning, the next morning you have a big hangover.
You feel silly about it.
These experiences stayed with yeah. the people and with you, which we're going to talk about in a second, when they were sober.
Yeah, one of the real hallmarks of the kind of the psychedelic experience is it has a concreteness and a reality. Unlike dreams, unlike being drunk or on other drugs, you really believe what you saw is revealed truth, not some subjective experience. And that's a really strange thing about these drugs.
Yeah.
I have some theories why it should be. I mean, I think one of the things that happens under a high dose experience is your ego dissolves, essentially. And when your ego dissolves, there's no in and out. There's no subjective objective. Everything is objective. And so the force, the conviction people leave these experiences with is powerful. And it can be very therapeutic. Because if you have some insight during a trip, like, geez, smoking, really not very good for me. You know, something really stupid and banal like that. If you have it during a psychedelic trip, it's like, oh, my God, the tablets. If this is true.
Yeah.
And you believe it in a way you never did before.
And you report some evidence that it can end one of the most difficult addictions.
Smoking.
A smoking addiction. So let's talk about you for a couple of seconds, not just your work. You were not a major experimenter? We're roughly in the same age group, three of us, when you were a kid.
I did not have really any experience of psychedelics in college or high school.
Why was that? What was wrong with you?
Well, I came of age at a moment when the backlash was in full flower, and everything you heard about psychedelics was terrifying. LSD scrambled your genes. College kids would stare at the sun till they went blind. People would take a trip and never come back.
Yeah. And peel off your skin. I remember reading that.
Yeah. Or the famous story of the guy who took so much orange sunshine for the rest of his life, he believed he was an orange. but most of these were not true. So I believed it all, and I was just terrified. And I didn't feel I was a sturdy enough person at that age to risk everything. And so this just wasn't part of my biography until I was nearing 60.
So when you started doing the research, was your original notion, in addition to tracing the history and the potential promise of psychedelics, that I will try them because that's what I have to do to be a responsible journalist? Or did that the trying them come later in the work?
No, I started writing about this. I wrote a long piece for The New Yorker.
Yeah. 2015?
Called The Trip Treatment, which is about giving the drugs to cancer patients at NYU and Johns Hopkins. And that was a very straight piece of science journalism. And while I was doing it, I was talking to people who were having these experiences that sounded so interesting, you know, that a single experience on a molecule could reset your thinking about death, that I just became really curious. What is that about? How can I really understand that experience without having it? So there was that. And I was talking to people who, I don't know, as you get to be our age, you sometimes can feel a little stuck in various grooves of thought and behavior that you wouldn't mind breaking out of. I mean, you know.
So were you nervous?
I was terrified.
And you had a guide, as you call it, correct?
Yes, I always work with a guide. Yeah. Not always. Most of the time I work with a guide. The night I did six or seven trips. I work with LSD, with psilocybin on two occasions, with ayahuasca on two occasions, and a very strange psychedelic called 5-MeO-DMT, which is the smoked venom of the Sonoran Desert Toad.
Is that for real?
For real.
The smoked
venom of the Sonoran Desert Toad.
Okay.
You can milk these toads. And
of course you can.
I mean, it's amazing that human ingenuity came up with that one.
So what was your first experience like?
So the first experience was an unguided trip on psilocybin and sort of in a more recreational sense, outdoors in my garden and in our house. And it was powerful. I had a very strong, you know, my interest, as I said at the beginning, is very much about nature. And I've always thought that we don't give plants enough credit for being aware of their environment and reacting appropriately. And plants became conscious. I was aware of them looking at me. I know this sounds really wanky, but I determined when I wrote this book I wasn't going to be embarrassed. I was just say what happened. And I had a sense of plant consciousness that I'd never had before. And
plant consciousness, that is so...
I know.
I'm with you completely.
Thank you, Marjorie.
I was devastated.
Okay, why don't you be transparent, since Michael Pollan is telling the truth about his life.
I think you could say that we were young and irresponsible once, and we may have investigated some of these things, but I don't know
how irresponsible. I mean, but yes.
Young and irresponsible?
We experimented.
I think most people would think it wasn't that responsible to try these different things. You didn't know
what was your first experience like?
I'm not going to get into my experience.
Why not?
Well, you tell
Michael
us
Pollan
yours.
Did.
Why don't you tell us yours?
Well, I was with my guide. This is. Let me do an OJ thing. If I did it, which I did, actually, I was with my guide. His name was Joe Kaharick. I went to University of Pennsylvania, and all my friends at Penn who were contemplating doing LSD when we were kids, the guy we picked was Joe Kaharick, who did not go to the school, but I don't even know how he got there, but he was there and was a friend to all of
us. What qualified him to be a guide?
I have no idea. Well, I assume he'd done it a lot, and he had been the guide for a few of our friends, so people felt comfortable with him. And I know my experience was not unlike that which I've heard from a lot of other people. Joe administers or hands me the LSD. I put it under my tongue, whatever, do the thing. And I keep saying to Joe what I thought was forever. It's not working. Obviously, it's not working. You know, Joe, you're great at what it's not. And then all of a sudden, oh, my God. And by the way, I'm not suggesting people should go out and do anything. You should make your own decisions. It was unlike anything I've ever experienced in my whole life. I don't know if I saw God. I don't know what I did, but I know that it was an otherworldly, life-changing kind of thing. It was unbelievable. And Marjorie may have had the same experience, but we won't talk about it.
We're talking with Michael Pollan about how to change your
Maybe
mind.
Maybe she will.
I want you to talk about the guy that was dying of cancer. And you talk about this in the book, that people are afraid of dying in many cases, and how his attitude changed after he tried some psychedelics.
So I spent a lot of time learning about a journalist who was my age named Patrick Metis. He was a news producer for MSNBC in New York, and he got bile duct cancer in his 50s, and it spread to his lungs, and he didn't have very long to live, and he was paralyzed by fear and anxiety. He heard about this trial going on at NYU. He got in, and he had a single, fairly high-dose psilocybin journey. And in this journey, he traveled through his life and met people who he had known in the past he had an experience in the middle of the journey of kind of climbing up on this precipice, and it was all like stainless steel, and looking over it, and there was this field of consciousness that he realized was in his future, and that he could go there now if he wanted to, and that this was what his death would be like. He'd kind of get folded into this consciousness, but he wasn't ready to go. He loved his wife very much, Lisa, and he stepped back, and he realized, I have more to do here, but that's where I end up, and I'm okay with that when I get there. And many other things happened, but this was a key, the key insight for him. And when that trip was over, he was he had this moment of ecstasy at the end, and his life was changed. He went on to live 17 more months. He spent that time. Part of it, he stayed on his chemo for a while. Then he gave it up because the quality of his life, he realized, was more important than the quantity at this point. And he died with an equanimity that his wife described, that his psychologist described, that was quite remarkable. Everybody in the hospital, he was at Mount Sinai in New York, the staff gravitated toward his room because of this emanation of love he was putting out. And shortly before he died, his wife took a photograph of him, and she sent it to me. And when I popped this photograph open on my computer, it just took my breath away. This emaciated man, oxygen clip, hospital gown, beaming. 5 days before his death. I mean, it was uncanny, and that was one of the things that made me realize I had to see what this was about.
Well, you know what else I find fascinating? You mentioned William James and his Varieties of Religious Experience, which is a fascinating book, which is a lot about mysticism.
Oh yeah,
and you look at people that whether talking about Confucius or Buddha or Thomas Merton, there are all these people that would call themselves mystics yeah. who've meditated for a long time or prayed for a long time all through history. So it's very interesting because that's their equanimity, that certainty of, or near certainty of faith. So it's very interesting how some people get there that way, and some people like Carlos Castaneda that we all read in college got there through mushrooms or other things. But it seems to be the same place.
Yeah,
and that you can't really talk about because people think you're nuts.
That's right. That's right. And also, there's this sense that a mystical experience achieved through prayer and meditation is the real thing, mm-hmm. and if it's achieved through molecules, it's cheating.
Or it's a shortcut, perhaps.
And it is a shortcut, but it's the same experience. And probably the mystical experience is mediated by the same brain chemistry, however it is caused.
Yeah.
And that all our experience is mediated by brain chemistry. And so, you know, Houston Smith, the scholar of religion, who was part of the experiment going on here in the early 60s, you know, he said there is no distinction between the kind of mystical experience that Merton and people like that were describing and this experience which he had had. And but one of the things that happens when you've had a mystical experience on a psychedelic is you understand that literature, which I was blind to it. It was like, it was so abstract. It made no sense, unifying with merging with the universe, all these things that seem so thin. You know, Emerson in The Common, saying, I was a transparent eyeball. The currents of reality were moving into my head. I thought that stuff was just like literary conceit. And then I had this experience. I was like, oh, that's what they were talking about. It's very hard to describe.
And you know what else I think is fascinating? You talk about, so people say, well, suppose this is all in your head.
Yeah.
And what was the answer you got to suppose this is all in your head?
Well, I mean, I asked the doctors. They said, you know, is this just an illusion you're giving people of immortality or that there's something after death? And they said one of a couple things. Some doctors said, who cares? If it helps people die, who cares? And others said, hey, we don't really know what happens after we die. This is above my pay grade. So I couldn't really get a straight answer on that. But there is no answer on that.
Michael Pollan, before you go, we've talked about potentially helping deal with smoking, with dealing with alcoholism, coping with death and beyond coping.
Oh, yeah, Bill Wilson, the guy that started Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. He thought he had a mystical experience on belladonna.
Well, he did have a mystical experience that got him sober.
Yeah.
And later in his career thought he had worked with LSD. The psychiatrists in UCLA were giving him LSD. And he realized this could really help people get sober. And he tried to introduce it to AA. And the board was like, this kind of muddies our brand.
I'm sorry.
Speaking of muddies, no, it's fine. Muddies our brand. Last thing, My guess is your goal was to crack some minds open for those who remember the worst of the Timothy Leary moment and the disgrace that this all fell into for those who admitted they were using psychedelic drugs. Is the world ready to have their mind cracked open?
Well, you know, I think I'm going to find that out in the next couple of weeks.
What are you finding?
So far, I've been out talking about this and doing a lot of media, and I get the sense, I just did a call-in show on Point, that people are ready to have another kind of conversation about this. That all the 60s baggage that covers these drugs, we might be ready to let it go. And when we are, we can just have a new kind of conversation where we look at them as potential tools. And we study them scientifically, and we share our experiences openly. I'm really encouraging people to come out of the closet, because so many people have a very important personal experience that they put in this box called weird drug experience, and they don't take it out. I think for some people, I'm kind of the occasion to take it out and think about it. And these are not just drug experiences. These are real psychological facts in your biography, and they're worth thinking about and worth learning from.
Michael, it's great to see you.
What do you think,
always.
Jim? You want to go for it again?
I'll talk to Michael after the show. Thank you, Marjorie. Enough is enough in terms of disclosure here. It's great to see you.
Thank you, guys.
And Michael Pollan is a professor of journalism at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. His latest book is How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence.
You know, we were just talking a minute ago. Let's continue with callers
to
get their reaction to what Michael had to say.
And Jim can tell you a few more
stories
about his...
No, I'm not telling you. I actually am telling you nothing more. So we're going to continue the conversation with you at 877-301-8970. What's your reaction to what you heard from Michael Pollan? If you want to share your own experiences, good and bad, we'd be happy to hear them. Give us a buzz.